Right, today I'm in Manchester with Paul Krishnamurti. Thanks very much for agreeing to do this today, Paul. Well, can you tell people watching, what is it you do for a living? Describe what you do.
Okay, so I always describe myself as a political gambler and a betting analyst, whether that is on politics or sport.
Okay, and you make a living from that?
Yeah, I've made a living professionally since 2003.
So you mentioned that you bet on sports and political markets. Which would be your most profitable area?
Cricket, definitely, because I do that basically every day, any match anywhere in the world. You know, Bangladesh v South Africa or the Pakistan Super League, because it's on every day. Politics is probably similar in the success rate over the 20 years or something, but obviously politics, it doesn't take place every week. You only get an election every so often or a leadership contest. And the other two sports play against snooker. I've got tremendous success rate at snooker, but it's not on that much. You know, it's been much better the last couple of years. There's been more tournaments, but if it's on, then I will focus big time on that. And other than that, golf, which I've been doing for years as well.
Okay, so why do you focus on those particular sports?
So it was really a process of elimination. You know, I was in the gambling industry for a long time, and it was, you know, pricing up markets, pricing up in running, really sort of came second nature. And, you know, when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, I gambled on everything and I took bets on everything. And, you know, when I started to take it more seriously, more professionally, you just realised that you've got to cut out the things that just aren't that productive. It's a waste of your energy and your time focusing. You know, I like horse racing, I like football, but I'll bet on horse racing or bet on football for a bit of fun because I can't have a success rate that I have in those sports.
Right, so some people might be a bit surprised that if you bet for a living that you still have fun bets.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you want a day out of the races, what are you going to do, not have a bet, you know?
Bet the racecourse bookies, hopefully. Yeah. So what would be your edge on, is it knowing more than everybody else?
Yeah, it's knowledge. It's knowledge and an understanding of markets and being able to price things up. I mean, the first thing I'd say anyone who's serious about betting is you've got to have knowledge and you've got to be committed to it. You know, again, part of the reason I don't do horse racing, for example, is because whilst I used to know a lot about horse racing, the time involved in knowing, in watching old races, in reading form, is extensive. Whereas, say, a sport like cricket, the players never really change. It's the same set of players playing for this team or that team. It's on every day. So you don't really need to do much research at all. It's a few minutes on the internet. Knowledge, and then also just being able to price things up. You can only get that with experience in bookmaking.
Mate, so give us a bit about your background then.
So I got into gambling when I was about 13. I was a total nerd. I've always been a total nerd. When I was a kid, I used to follow the world snooker rankings down to number 100, right? You know, in my little book, I used to monitor the performances of all the players in the various football leagues through reading Shoot and Match. And then I got to 13, and my sister's friend was looking after me when I was going to the football down Southampton. And he took me to the, and he said, look, just wait outside, mate, I've got to go to the bookies. And he brought out a football coupon with him. And I was just addicted. I was like, wow, well, I can win money predicting this thing that I'm totally obsessed with. So I went back and I became a school bookie, basically. And I had in my head at the age of 14, 15, I'm going to work in the industry as soon as I'm 18. And really, that was an inevitable path. When I was 18, I went and worked in the industry for 7 years, and I've never really been out of it.
So many of my interviewees have admitted they were the school bookie, including John McCruick. Did you surprise them up yourself, or did you offer the bookies odds? And how many takers did you get in school?
So in the first place, in the first instance, it was literally a case of bringing the football coupon to school, right? And getting people to engage in it, talk about it really. But then I would do the live matches, right? So, you know, you used to get one match a week back then in the 80s. But what I would do is I would basically write the prices down in the shop and take a point off everything. And then as soon as I was in the industry, I wanted to know how to price things up. And I was doing how to manage, I did settling courses. So suddenly I knew about overrounds and percentages. And once I knew that, I was never going to go back, you know.
So what gave you the idea to be a school bookie in the first place? Was the motivation money?
No. Well, I suppose it was, but it was more a case, it was about being right. It was about, you know, I wanted other people to engage in this thing that I was just so into. I mean, when I saw a football coupon, when I first got that football coupon and took it home, I probably studied it for 6 hours. What, you know, this, it was with maths, right? And, you know, I loved all that. I mean, if you're really into sport, isn't betting just second nature? If you love tennis, if you love Wimbledon, right? And you've got an opinion that back then it would have been Pat Cash or Ivan Lendl or someone, right? And you really think it's Pat Cash or you really want that, why wouldn't you have a 50p on him at 10 to 1? And, you know, there was, it was that sort of bet. You could go around, I'd probably take 30 or 40 bets on something like the Open or the Wimbledon, all at maximum bet a pound or something. But everyone was happy with it. There was never any complaints. No one ever got any trouble, you know.
Well, do you think school bookies still exist these days when gambling... I mean, like you say, I totally agree. I'm guessing many people watching this will, that there's nothing wrong with it. But it's being given a stigma by people in the political arena. Do you think, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my school weren't in favour. I got in a bit of trouble over it. I didn't really care. I doubt it exists so much now, apart from anything, because they've all got mobile phones. They watch Sky Sports, so they know a bit more about it. But... the political conversation is a bit crazy, really. I mean, if you really wanted to be against gambling, then you'd look at the whole big picture, wouldn't you? You'd look at advertising, you'd look at the fact that it's normalised. You wouldn't then just say, oh no, it's these specific machines in these shops that's doing all the damage. If we just take the machines away, it'll all be fine. You know, we've made that decision now as a country, and we've... What are we going to do? Not have all the sports sponsored by bookies? What are we going to do? Not have who's going to pay for all the adverts on Sky Sports?
No. Yeah, that's a very good question. Mm. Now, you were so keen that you started working in a William Hill betting shop aged 18. And then you went on to be a manager for an independent at 25. Was it just the draw of the... what you love so much that made you go into betting shops, or?
Yeah, I mean, before I was 18, I was in the bookies all the time with my £5 trying to turn it into 10, you know. And so as soon as I was old enough to know I could get a job, and then once you get the job and you think, if you're a gambler, you just get in, you put the papers up in the morning, and then you've got 3 hours to read the Racing Post and plan the day and then watch it all. So it was a busman's holiday, as it were. But I did that for 7 years, but after about 4 or 5, I was fed up of it. I didn't like the nights, the Sunday racing, etc. So I pursued something else.
And that something else was going to university as a mature student to study politics.
Mm.
Why that direction?
Well, I could have done, I always knew I could have gone to university from school. Right, I literally started in sixth form. I did history and politics. I did one essay on American politics, got a B+, and then a 150 quid on a play spot the next day. Right. And at Newmarket, I think it was in October sort of time, whatever that meeting is, a Dewhurst meeting, I think. I never looked back. I was just, once I got that, it was like, nah, I'm not going back. I'm just going to gamble and, chance me arm. But obviously I regretted that, and a lot of my friends went to university and they were quite, I would sit and talk about politics and elections and everything else and culture. And I just, by my early 20s, I was like, I've got to do this. This is my passion. So when I went to uni, it was really, I didn't have any intention on staying in the betting industry at all. I continued to gamble to supplement my income at uni, but it was a new path, as it were.
So why, you say it was your passion. Was your passion to go and get a good education, or was politics your passion?
Politics. And a good education. Both. I mean, I've got that sort of mind. I've got an inquisitive mind. So the moment that I started engaging in politics as an adult, I just wanted to know more. I was just boring everybody talking about it. I might as well go and you know, talk to people who really do. And then when I actually went to the interview at uni, I was just blown away. You go to a library and all that knowledge is like anything you want to find out in front of you. And I just embraced that. I really, you know, it was a very exciting thing.
So when you finished university, you came out and you got a job in politics and off you went?
No. Ah. No, well, because of course, you know, you're graduating at, how old would I have been, 28. You know, you've got a life to pay for now, you're an adult. And so I did two things. First of all, I started working as an intern for a Newsnight journalist, who's an American political journalist, who actually, with hindsight, very influential on me. But that was small money, you know, that was a bit of part-time money, right, an experience. So I needed a full-time job to supplement it, so I went to work at SOS, the Racing Channel, which was the perfect part-time job. It was exactly as Betfair was coming into relevance. And I've never worked with a shrewder bunch of people. We had an office full of guys who just love sport and love gambling and 20 TVs, watching them all. And I guess immediately it became apparent, as well as political betting options that had become available, that, well, hang on, like 3 years ago when I left, or 4 years ago when I left work, there wasn't much future in this for me. Now, I could see absolutely how I could make a living on Betfair.
But before you did that, you went to 365. You were in 365.
Yeah. So for 2.5 years after leaving uni, I was basically working in the betting industry, doing a bit of investigative journalism that then got dropped in my spare time, but also I was practicing to be a professional. So my last year at 365, because my job there was week on, week off nights, so I got a lot of spare time. During that last year, I practiced Betfair as a sort of semi part-time thing, and I made a good living doing that. It was like, okay, I can do this now.
Amazing. So what were you actually doing at 365?
I was working in content. It was editing teletext, editing the website. It was no form of like actual gambling. It was just content.
Okay, you've mentioned that you spent the last bit of your time at Bet 365 learning how to win, basically. So I'm assuming that it was at that point that you realised that you had a consistent aptitude for winning. So tell us about taking the plunge to go full-time punting.
So yeah, so this last year was very much a practice thing. Now I can tell you, that last year, semi-professionally, I made 12 grand, right? And had I made 12 grand with three major wins paying for most of it, that wouldn't have been convincing. But actually, I made money every month in that year. I made money 12 months running of some description, and it averaged out of that, doing it part-time. So I was like, well, that's consistency. And likewise, you know, when I turned pro, in all that time, in 16 years, I probably only had half a dozen losing months. You know, it's consistent. It's not always consistent, the same amount, and a lot of time you may not make a lot, but you're not losing that often, especially with the ability to cash out and to amend situations that you have with Betfair now. You shouldn't really, I'm not saying I never do get caught in a hole, it shouldn't happen.
So you're concentrating on the golf, the cricket, the snooker, and politics. Mm. So what is your game? What's your angle? What are you trying to get out of each market? I mean, I don't mean monetarily. What is your angle to?
Well, the first angle that really would apply to anyone on Betfair, and I always say this, you know, don't look at a market as being one market. Don't say to yourself, who's going to win the Open Golf? You can say that, of course. The bigger issue is that the Open Golf, as it's happening, is a market of 20 people involving 20 separate markets. And all you've got to do to make something is be correct about the way the odds, the movement of the odds on one player. You know, you could say to yourself, any given day, I'm going to have one bet today, and it's that this dog running at Bellevue tonight will shorten by 20%, right? Now, I think that if you know about dog racing, you know about betting, you know, then that's not that hard to predict, you know, to find your one thing that you know about. So if you then take golf, right, say, for me, a great angle on the golf is knowing the golf course, knowing where the scoring is, knowing where there's a run of three easy holes, three hard holes. And I might be just watching two players who are three shots off the pace, and I know that they're coming to the easy stretch of the golf course. So that's the time to back them. Now, if you're doing that and you're getting the best odds and you know how to get the best odds on Betfair, you're going to get a lot of edges doing that, taking slightly the wrong price over, taking a slightly inflated price, even if it's by 5%, 10%, all the time. And you're holding it as a position to get rid of later. And likewise with cricket is a huge betting sport, right? And there is so much knowledge to it. There are so many nuances. You know, it's the weather, it's the pitch, it's the who's coming in next, it's the particular bowler whose turn it's going to be, because they've just had an hour break, you know they're going to be coming back. And if you've got all that knowledge and you've got 20 different markets moving constantly in play, there's going to be a chance somewhere in one of those markets for you to have a slight edge. And once you have that slight edge and you take it, and then you look for the next edge, and you're basically managing, it's complicated, but basically if you're taking the wrong odds all the time, you're going to win.
Now, it's interesting you were saying about that with cricket, because of any sport, I would imagine that cricket is only really, apart from, you know, the massive matches, only really watched by people that know about cricket. And even less people betting on it that aren't really clued up on cricket. So what is it that you see that other people don't?
I wouldn't necessarily say that the people betting it don't know, actually, because I think cricket's kind of like a subculture in its own right. Someone called me a cricket tragic recently. I love that. Once you're in, you're in. I think that the thing that I'm seeing is just probably I'm just doing a bit more research and I'm doing it more consistently. So, for example, something like reverse swing, right? If you need a very dry pitch to get reverse swing. And so very often, it won't reverse early in the innings, right? But the commentators will be noting that this is a dry pitch, blah, blah, maybe some reverse swing later. Then you reach the 30th or the 40th over or the 50th over when the reverse swing is due. Very rarely, if ever, will the market factor that in. The market will be assuming that conditions stay the same, but you've already got it in your head that at about 2 o'clock today, it's going to get very hard to bat. And if you've got that advanced bit of knowledge in your hand, you're ahead of all of these markets, you're going to get an angle, because you're going to see the prices move and you're going to be one of the first people to react.
Okay, so a lot of this stuff, a lot of this knowledge is knowledge that you've built up over the years.
Yeah.
So do you, as a professional horse racing punter, would know all that stuff, but they still have to get up in the morning and put the hours in. Now, do you have to do that with what you do? Do you have a routine?
So this is a part of the reason I do those sports. So, yeah, with cricket, I really don't need to do hardly any research like to bet in running. If I wanted to write a preview for a match, obviously, then I'd do a little bit more before. But if I'm just betting on it, you know, let's just say that it's a Pakistan Super League tomorrow. I don't need to, I will literally go online when they're doing the toss. I know the pitch already because I've used it yesterday or the day before. I know the ground already. I know the players. And yeah, no extra research is really needed. You can just immediately go into it. With golf, that involves a few hours on Monday and Tuesday, running through all the stats, running through, you know, countless indicators that you use. Again, golf, like cricket, so many nuances, so many angles, so many little bits of knowledge that most people won't know.
Would you consult maybe what somebody like Jeremy Chapman's written, or would you, everything going to be your own?
That's an interesting question, actually. Absolutely, but I think that the thing that I do always do in terms of a routine is I do that afterwards. My first thing is I have a particular sort of stats approach using the sites that I use. So the very first thing I'll do on a Monday is I will employ that approach and get a long short list and make a few comments about, say, 10 players. And then I'll look at the betting and I'll see how that factors into what I've already said. And then I'll start reading Jeremy Chapman or Ben Coley, Sporting Life. And, you know, you're just adding to the pool, because they might make see something you don't. As it actually happens, I tend to think with golf that most of the tipsters are fairly much in agreement most of the time. You know, if you took the 10, 20 best known golf tipsters and we all had a conversation on a Monday about our five players, we'd only come up with 15 players between us, or 18, you know.
Do you, you're talking about your trading and your betting and running, do you ever, you know, take a position early with the fixed odds bookies?
Yeah, absolutely. Often fixed odds bookies are the best. I mean, I can't get on online at all, but you know, you can go in a shop. If you take the Open last week, I mean, the bookies were offering 10 places on the Open. It's an absolute no-brainer in that situation that if you fancy a player who's any sort of price, 25 to 1 or bigger, even if they're 30 on the exchange compared to 25, who's 32, take the 25 to 1 each way, 10 places, take a few of them, and then worry about it on Sunday. Look to get out of those positions on Sunday when that's been exposed as the wrong price, if you like.
Okay, what sort of figures are we talking about that you bet in to provide yourself with a, you know, a proper income?
Yeah, not as big as you might think. I mean, put aside, the biggest loss I've ever had, which we'll probably get to, is 15 grand. You know, Donald Trump, it was devastating. It's more a case of betting solidly in 50s and 100s and 200s, maybe 3-4 on a cricket runs bet. But it's more about the volume than about the individual stakes. I very rarely put all my eggs in one basket. You know, politics is probably the unique case about that, that you only have two or three options. It's not such a trading event, so you do end up sometimes putting all your eggs in one basket.
Okay, so when it is going a bit wrong, how do you stop yourself going on tilt, as they say?
Well, to be honest, I don't really have a problem with that, because I do so much of it, I could do with a break, right? And, you know, to be honest, this year, cricket's been difficult this year. I've had a couple of bad months on cricket. It's good overall, but nowhere near as what I'm used to. That hasn't made me bet on anything else. What actually happened is I finished that innings, which is bad, and I just go for a walk. I'll go for a walk for now, get some air, right? Get it out of my head, start thinking about something else, and then try and be fresh the next day. Like, I never chase anything.
One of the bugbears of professional punters, especially ones using exchanges, well, one exchange in particular, the premium charge. You suffer from that?
I have done. I'm on a fixed rate now.
Okay, right. Moving swiftly on then. Politics. Now, it's been very, very hard to predict in recent years. You mentioned that you'd done 15 bags when Donald Trump won the US election, presidential election. Why do you think it's become like it is?
The rules have changed. Everything's changed. This is like the reinvention of the printing press. The world we knew up until 2014, perhaps it's earlier, but in the UK, 2014, I think, is now established as the point at which it changed. Most people got their information, got their narrative, got their worldview from a very small number of sources. The commentariat, the intelligentsia, you know, the BBC, the ITV, those people, they did shape public opinion hugely. Right, and just popular understanding of things. Then along came the internet. And the internet is the Wild West. And now we are dealing with, across the world, massive abuse of data. You're talking about voters in virtually every country being targeted by military psyops type operations like Cambridge Analytica, spreading fake news, spreading divisive information. And we've got foreign intelligence services. We know that Russia are involved everywhere, right? But they're not the only country that does it. And so when you're talking about betting on it, we would go into, say, 2014. And actually, it started with 2015. Let's actually go back before that, because the thing that really inspired me to do it more for a living was I backed Jeremy Corbyn, right? Jeremy Corbyn, I was tipping him at 100 to 1, right, before he even went in, because they said he might. When he got in the race, he was 28 to 1, outsider of 4. I wrote a piece within 5 minutes, right, saying, get on Corbyn, great value, right? Win or lose, he'll be in top two, he's got a chance, right? And literally, nobody in the mainstream media for 2 to 3 weeks took any of it seriously. They dismissed him completely. And I was like, you know, I was following Labour Party members. I was joining Facebook groups. I was following the social media activity. And it's like, we live in parallel universes here. I'm living in a thing where Corbyn gets 50% every time you ask a Labour member, right? And you've got these people who, on you know, highly educated, highly connected insiders on the TV saying, oh, he's got no chance because they've spoken to a few MPs, but it's not decided by MPs, it's decided by the people. So I could see it changing there. And again, Corbyn, very much the first social media candidate. And then we move on to Trump. And Trump defies every single indicator there is in history. And again, this was because the conventional sources of information that would have told you everything you need to know about him were no longer relevant. And now you had the internet and you had fake news and you had data targeting.
Now, you went to America, actually went to America in 2016 just to bet on the US election. Now, given the result, did you make that pay?
Not in gambling terms, no. It'll be my great story to the day I die. I made 11 grand up until the general election. I got a lot right. I didn't get Trump right. When Trump won the nomination, that's more important to me than the Clinton thing. I backed Ted Cruz to win like $500,000, right? And I had everyone else in that Republican race for a lot of money. And the bet was generally just, they will stop Trump. They will have a brokered convention and they will stop him, right? Because they have the means to do it. And it looked like it was going to happen for ages and ages, and it didn't. And I cashed out and I made 8 grand out of that. But it was like, it was a blow from what the position I was sitting on. And then I went into that general election. It's the biggest mistake I've ever made in my life. Going into that general election, the day before, Trump loses me 28 grand, Clinton wins me 25 grand. But she is 1.15 on Betfair. Now, we know what to do in that situation. She went shorter than that. I just got greedy. I was drinking, I was at a party, I was meeting with all these cool people in America, Democrats, strategists and whatnot. And every person you ever met said, he can't win, he can't win. Look at the numbers, look at the demographics, he can't win. And suddenly, and it was going that way, that night was going that way, no one was in question. And then suddenly, bang, some results started coming in from the East Coast and you're in panic mode. And I ended up bailing out at even money and halved the loss at even money. But you know, it's a crime because I really should have made at least 5 or 6 just cashing out. You know?
Now, you were busy with media work over there. I've did a bit of research like I always do, and lots of little clips of you on cable TV and national, I don't know what TV channels they were, but how did you manage to get yourself into that position?
Crazy story. Like, again, it was just after basically the 2015 UK election. I did some work for Betfair, did some films, helped manage their Betfair Predicts project. And that was the first time I'd ever really, you know, done anything for a wider audience. And immediately this American TV presenter gets in touch with me and says, we're doing a show about political betting. Do you want to come over and be the guest and we'll pay for you and put you up and all that? So I went over there, I met all these people, and they were all going, God, you've got to come over here for 2016. It's going to be, you know, what you do is completely unique over here, right? So I went over there. It was as much of a adventure as a career move, if you like. I mean, it's helped my career, it's got my work yet, and hopefully next year, I haven't really started pitching yet, but hopefully I'll do something over there next year. But it was living the dream, really. It was like, you know, if you're into politics and betting, why wouldn't you want to do that, you know?
So given the disastrous result, did you cop more money out of the media work than you did the punting?
Yes.
Now, you also seem to be the go-to guy for UK politics betting. If anybody wants to talk about that, they get you on. How have you managed to put yourself into that enviable position?
Just I think by relentlessly writing about it and covering it. I mean, that's really how I got into it with Betfair, which, as I say, I did it before the 2015 UK election. I did a lot of American stuff as well. But really, from 2015 onwards, I've just been completely on it. And look at the times we live in. I mean, just to compare how things have changed. Let's go between 2010 and 2015, the Cameron government. All there was to bet on during that time was the next general election, 5 years away, the odd by-election, the Europeans. You know, they're once a year events, right? Nobody changed leader during that time. You didn't even get a leadership contest. And then all of a sudden, this situation emerges where you have Labour leadership contest, Brexit referendum, Scottish referendum just before that, sorry. So Brexit referendum. And then once Brexit happens, there's a betting heat every day. I mean, I wrote a piece, the last piece I wrote on Brexit and will there be an election this year. And at the bottom of it, I'm just listing how many markets are relevant to it. There's about 20 markets, you know, and it's just constant every day. Like, will there be an election? What will happen first, an election or Brexit? And I think to be able to analyse those markets, you've really got to follow it. You've really got to know your stuff. So I don't suppose there's that many people in the betting game who follow it to the extent I do.
And do you listen to Inside Information?
It's a good question. I mean, I hate Inside Information. If I was betting on horses, for instance, I'd just totally reject it because who knows? I think... yes, if I got something I trusted, I would. I don't think you do get much. I actually think it's more about... You know, I quite enjoy my distance from the insiders. I've got nothing to do with Westminster. I don't know anyone in Westminster, right? And I think that distance actually gives me a bit of an edge because they're a bubble, just like everybody else lives in a bubble. And you couldn't have picked Corbyn, for instance. You couldn't have picked Ted Cruz, right? If you were in that circle, because those people would tell you that we've got some inside information that our establishment candidate is polling really well in these. It's like, it's more to it than that.
Now, I'm told that you ignore polls. You rather talk to the punters in the street and go to the pub and hear the conversation there. So how much of that do you do?
Well, it's a bit of both. I don't ignore polls. I think polls are very useful. Right, they are a snapshot, right? And there's a big margin of error, right? And you have to take a number of polls in the round to get a broad picture. The thing about interviewing people specifically, and this is what I did a lot in America. I've never done it as a job in this country to do that, but it's what I do. You know, I'm really into politics, and the minute you get in a conversation with someone, they don't ask you what you do, it starts, and you just want to hear what they have to say, and you just want to hear their... And yeah, absolutely, I think it's absolutely useful, not necessarily as a direct predictor of an election, because obviously you go and meet a Labour supporter in a Labour area, what do they know about the rest of the country? They're not representative, and vice versa. But I think it does give you a very different narrative to the one that the media would give you. And you realise how much of it is simplistic and tribal. Something like Brexit, for instance. I don't believe anybody, hardly anybody in this country, knew beforehand what the single market or the customs union were. They still don't. It's just not a conversation. You will never meet people in a pub at a bus stop and they'll be arguing about tariff-free access from Europe. It will be straightforward about identity or about something they've read. A popular myth that they've read. That's what, and I think that the political class, as it were, the insiders, they assume that everybody knows what they do, and they just don't because people aren't that engaged. It's not their jobs to do that.
Right. Now, yeah. Do you actually go to by-election areas to get yourself an edge if there's a tight by-election?
I've never done that. It would be a good thing to do. You don't get that many that are that unpredictable. The other thing about by-election, of course, is the turnout's so pitifully low that the chances are if you spoke to the average person, the average swing voter, they wouldn't even know what was going on.
Right, now, have you got any political ambitions yourself? Do you fancy being one of them?
No, I've never fancied being one of them. I don't think I've been good at it. But I do, I am writing, I have been writing for several years without getting done, various very deep analysis of world politics. So that was what I'd really love to do. I would like to be a full-time political journalist. I would like to, and regarding the stuff we're discussing about Trump, Corbyn, Brexit, the change, information, fake news, data, I've got a 20-year story to tell, which is going to be told when I eventually get that book written.
They're talking about this, you're obviously keen, you're talking about the media there. Mm. Now, a lot of people, when I interview professional punters, say, oh, hang on a minute, why is he bothering with all that? He's not a professional punter, he's just winning a few quid and getting... I mean, are you so interested in the media work? Does that not distract from the main business of making a few quid gambling?
Okay, so it's a good point. Yeah, it probably does distract me. It probably does. I think if I devoted all of my attention solely to winning money, then I'd win more, no doubt about that. But then we go back to who I am, you know, and who I really want to be, as it were. And when I quit the game in the first place, I went to go and study politics at university to be an investigative journalist. And I never, that passion never stopped. The investigative stuff is something that I've just done for fun for 20 years. I know a lot of stuff because I'm interested in it. And so, yeah, in an ideal world, I suppose I would be a political pundit who likes a bet, rather than a professional gambler who writes about politics.
Okay, so people are watching this primarily because they want to learn from you, and they've no doubt learned a fair bit already. In a nutshell, I know it's difficult, how can punters get an edge in anything?
Well, so first of all, knowledge in anything. I mean, this was what going to university really taught me. You know, specialise. You don't have to know everything, right? I used to know every footballer virtually in the four leagues. Now I probably couldn't name you 10 because I just cut it out. I just cut it out and replaced it with something that was thing that I had some expertise in. So number one, knowledge. Number two, discipline, obviously, and you can't stress that enough. You know, write your bets down, write them down, keep a record. Even if you're just having £2 here, £2 there, whatever, you just want to mess about, keep a record. And at some point, when you've got a minute, go through that record, separate them and say, these were my bets on football and cricket, on snooker and on these particular markets. And I think that it becomes really clear. That's what I did. I just wrote everything I did down, and it became obvious that I'm putting all this time into football and I'm losing. I put this much amount of time in cricket, look at the profits to do that. And then thirdly, it really, you cannot underestimate the ability, the skills that you learn from learning about odds making. This, you know, all the betting nowadays, as constructed by bookies, is done on algorithms. Right? An algorithm is great for the overall, but you can beat them if you've got extra knowledge. You can absolutely beat them if you've got a particular understanding about the way that a sport, the trajectory of the market moves in running, and you can price something up on the go, right? Then you have an edge. I mean, I learned this doing the craziest sort of gambling. Me and my mates, when we were kids, we would bet on everything. We would pause the video on EastEnders and say, right, betting on who speaks next. Yeah, 6-4 Sharon, 3-1 Phil Mitchell, blah blah. Now, when you're doing that on everything, on the next record to come on the radio, it becomes second nature. And all of us who did that in our mid 40s, even though they don't do it anymore, I guarantee if I said to them, okay, what odds you give me on like something, anything, they'd be pretty close because they understand. Okay. They have that level of expertise.
So finally, What are you doing in 20 years? Time.
I'll be gambling, that's for sure, because how can you not? I mean, there's never going to come a time in my life, you know, even if, like, you know, the government called me as an advisor or something, right? I was working for the BBC. I still want to watch the World Snooker Championship, and there's no way I'm watching any game at the World Snooker Championship without a bet, because I've got an opinion, right? There's no way I'm ever going to go into an election and not have a bet, because I'm always going to have an opinion. So I guess pretty much the same. You know, hopefully more of politics and more of journalism, but I'll never stop gambling on those, the things I love.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Paul Krishnamurti, thank you very much.
Pleasure.